This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasodhi in our Health and Living segment. It's our seventh episode of our public health series. Azrul Muhammad Khaled from the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy in the studio with me. And we're going to be discussing today's episode is on mental health. Welcome, Azrul. How are you today?
Just recovering from flu. Yeah. I'm a little bit drugged up, so if I sound a little bit hyper, that's the reason why.
It's all right. So it works very well for radio, Azrul, don't worry. Mental health is something that we're going to be discussing today. It is inseparable from our overall health and quality of life, but, you know, statistics on mental health problems are alarming. The World Health Organization has reported that one in four people will be affected by mental health problems in their lifetime. In Malaysia, it's actually one in three adults who have been affected by mental health problems, and these are figures from 2015. I'm pretty sure that this number is underestimated. I mean, it's not the correct numbers. I'm sure we're not capturing everybody, but then still, one in three is quite a lot of us. So it is a very poorly understood topic, a lot of stigma attached to it. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. Joining us also, Dr. Nurashikin Ibrahim, for the public health physician from the Mental Health Unit in Ministry of Health. She's better known as Dr. Anne. Welcome to the show, Dr. Anne. How are you?
Thank you, Meera. I'm fine.
And she's also the singing public health physician for the Ministry of Health. I've watched her in action. It's really something else altogether.
You've heard that.
Yes, I have. And joining us also from the Penang Institute, analyst Lim Soo Lin. Welcome to the show, Soo Lin. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me, Meera.
Soo Lin has actually done some research at the Penang Institute on these issues, so she will reveal some of that as we go along. So let's talk about mental health. How is it actually defined, Dr. Anne?
Okay. According to the World Health Organization, I think mental health is defined as it's a situation defined by WHO in 2001, in fact. It's a situation whereby a person realizes his or her potentials, can cope with the normal stresses of life every day, and can work productively and can contribute to the society or to the community. So basically, when you talk about mental health, it's a totally, some people, when you talk about mental health, a lot of people skewed it to mental illness, but basically, you need to have that equilibrium. And so on certain days, your mental health may be good, and certain days it may be compromised. So that broad of spectrum of that, when you talk about mental health problems or mental health issues, you know, so you've got to have that equilibrium, but you do not have it all the time.
I'm very curious. So none of us are at equilibrium.
No, not necessarily. But you've got, because when you talk about mental health, there are other definitions like mental health problems, whereby when you are affected due to some stress or some problems, and you have your thoughts affected, your cognitive function, your social interactions with people. So when that is severely affected, you tend to have mental health problems, and it can manifest as many symptoms that maybe we can discuss later, because there's a fine thin line between sometimes when you talk about, are we having stress or are we having depression? And depression is not something to play with. You know, people often like...
use the word loosely.
Yeah. Very loosely, like, I'm depressed, you know. I hear this news, you know. But the news is just like, for example, you couldn't get what you want because you go to... For example, it's a bad example. You go to McDonald's, you want an ice cream, and then somebody was telling you, okay, ice cream machine not functioning. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, yeah, I'm depressed, you know. That is not depression. Yeah. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful
to understand it better. Mm-hmm. If you have a question on mental health, whether or not it's on a policy level or research, or if you have concerns, just give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Now, the 1 in 3 number, Dr. Anne, is that accurate or not?
Yes, because we have actually, we do our national, in the Ministry of Health, every 5 years, we have our National Health and Morbidity Survey being done by the Public Health Institute. And the previous surveys was done in the same manner and the same way that was initially conducted in the year 1996, found out that the mental health problems was 10.6%, and it has risen threefold. That means 29.2. That was way back in the year 2015. I would say some people, it's like alarming to say one in three, but probably like three in ten. You know, and that's the figure that they are. A lot of people are using it now.
What's our population now? 33 million?
Yeah.
We are 33 million, are we?
Well, 31.
31 million.
31 okay. Going up.
So that's about 11 million of us, roughly.
Have mental health problems or some form of mental health issues. These are not diagnosed because we do not use... it's not a diagnosis of a mental illness. But then when we did another, the same survey, but focusing just on one of the mental disorders, that is depression, in the year 2011, we have not done it yet, we have not repeated it, we found that about approximately 1.8%, prevalence of 1.8% of the population then, above 16 years old and above, had depression. That means was diagnosed to have depression, because you actually go down to actually diagnosed it, and it is a second. We can't do two stage because of our resources.
I think that was just to interject. I think that was a very important point that you brought up as well, Dr. N. That in fact the scale that you used in 2015 and 2011 were very different.
Was different
survey instruments. So in 2015, they used something called the GHQ.
General Health Questionnaire.
Which is a measure of psychological distress and not necessarily something that leads to a diagnosable mental health disorder.
So people need to understand that, that actually we are looking at a bigger, like a bird's view. It's a bigger picture of people having mental health issues. For example, you can't sleep at night. Mm-hmm. You are having trouble, you know,
concentrating.
Okay. So it's not a diagnosed mental health condition. Yes. As such. So
that was for 2015.
Okay. All right. But that's the one in three.
That's the one in three. Yeah. Okay. And 29.2%, about 4.2 million.
Then, so it's us not being in equilibrium, the 11 million of us. Is that what you're saying? Some of us may have issues, but we don't know what the breakdown is.
We do not know the exact breakdown of the mental disorders as yet, because we are seeing that more and more people are probably coming up to get and to seek help for conditions like even depression. And I think to a certain extent, suicidal behavior, even if suicidal behavior is not a mental disorder, but it is an outcome of whatever mental health issues that you're facing.
Manifestation.
Yes. Suicidal behavior ranges from suicidal ideation, suicidal plan, attempt, and even the suicide act. So I think we can also focus the statistics to the young people, because apparently when we the things that we are looking at the National Health Mobility Survey, but now the National Health Adolescent Survey that was done in the year 2017 yielded that prevalence of suicidal behavior among it was suicidal ideation. Has risen from 7.9 to in the year 2012 when we did that, and last year it rose to 10%. This is the
The prevalence amongst adolescents has
adolescents, yeah, but it is actually between those aged 13 to 17, the ones who are in the secondary schools, and that's a little bit not to say distressing, but we should be actually
concerned.
We should be concerned about that, because a lot of people are putting the symptoms, like for example, under, not to say how would I put it, they are probably not ready enough to actually come forward to tell people about your problems. And even when we did our we had our campaign in the year. We had our sort of World Mental Health Day. I think one of the years
World
was
Health Day.
Yeah, World Health Day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, depression. Let's talk.
That's right.
Yeah, and we are encouraging people, even if you're not depressed, to actually be able to talk about depression and be able to be comfortably talking about it. But even then, I think more campaigns and more awareness. Mm-hmm. Although I do agree that awareness is there. You know, people are coming, but people are still the majority. The stigma needs to be actually. You need to break the stigma. Yeah.
I remember even the British Royals came out to talk about depression that year.
Kate,
Sorry, can I just interject here? Just backtrack a bit. just so that we understand, on the scale, the spectrum of mental health, I mean, what is the mildest form and what is the most severe form? Just so that I think we get an idea as to what we're actually talking about and what falls in between. Because the statistics sound quite alarming. Kids not doing homework and get punished by the teacher also could be considered. So what are we talking about in terms of the mildest form and the most severe?
Sulin?
Sulin, maybe.
I think, well, we need to go back to what we define as mental health, in a sense. And I acknowledge that this is actually something quite difficult to do, because the way that we even talk and perceive and think about mental health will depend on our own systems of belief. You know, it feeds into our cultural notions, our religious upbringing, and so on and so forth. And in Malaysia, I think we are all quite aware that we live in a multi-ethnic, multilingual, multicultural society. So we have pockets of communities that think and talk and approach mental health in very different ways. So it's complicated, to put it at best, to pin down an exact definition of what constitutes good mental health. But I think we can certainly draw out certain universal elements. So things like having basic cognitive and social skills, being able to recognize and express and moderate one's own emotions and empathize with others, having the flexibility to cope with difficult life events and function in social roles, having a harmonious relationship between your body and your mind. All these contribute to, as the word you used was equilibrium, if I remember, Dr. N, and I think that's a very apt way to describe it.
It's a little bit tricky when you talk about good mental health.
Because you don't want to fall into the trap of saying that mental health is all about championing positive emotions and a good sense of happiness, because it is possible to be in good mental health and still experience sadness, anger, unhappiness. This is part of a fully lived life as a human being, right? But I think what we try to, and what I personally think is a good way to approach this very grey sort of area is to think about it in terms of a dynamic equilibrium. So mentally healthy people can experience appropriate human emotions, fear, anger, sadness, grief, happiness, and all of that, while possessing the ability or the resilience to restore that state of equilibrium. And we also have to bear in mind that at different life stages,
you
would need to reorientate yourself. Adolescence is a very tricky period where we sort of the hormonal imbalances will lead us to explain all sorts of emotions.
Where were all of you when I was growing up?
it's
awareness and understanding of it. Because you don't know it's normal, right? Yeah. You don't realize that it's normal. So, Lynn, we've seen a threefold increase in people affected by mental health problems between 1996 and 2015. Do we know the possible reasons for that increase?
Well, I can think of a few root factors. I think the key one would be, simply put, an increase in population, and together with that, the attendant urbanization that has happened. According to UN projections, more than 2/3 of the developing world will live in urban rather than rural areas by 2030. Sure. And Malaysia is no stranger to this trend as well. I mean, we've seen expansion of cities, the increasing scale and magnitude of rural-urban migration. But urbanization isn't just a demographic movement. It's also one that creates, I think, very profound social and economic and psychological changes. You can think about it in the sense of, well, you can situate it in terms of what happens when you have development, right? Increased scale and proportion of people moving, that creates a pressure on resources needed to support basic needs. If you think about cities, adequate housing, a good environment that is conducive to good health and good nutrition. When there is a pressure on these resources, what it does is it creates pockets of communities who are deprived, who live in socioeconomically disadvantaged conditions. You have communities who are vulnerable to low education, unemployment, and are at greater risk of developing physical as well as mental health issues, mm-hmm. I would say.
It's interesting even we do see people outside of that socioeconomic status who are suffering with mental health issues as well.
Correct.
So that's an interesting... So urbanization being one contributing factor, but there are others obviously as well.
I would say urbanization has multiple dimensions to it. So the first one that I mentioned had to do with...
increasing population.
Yes, and pressure on resources. But it also brings about a very profound dynamic change in your social structure. When you have people moving away from their homes, leaving maybe parents, dependents to care for themselves, that creates less of availability of caregivers when families age, when parents get older. You then have the context of living in the city, the pressures of urban living, the changing social fabric, people becoming more... burdened by the rising cost of living. These are all intangible things that come about with urbanization, I would say.
Because basically, I think although probably one of the factors when you talk about urbanization, high rising cost of living and things like that, but the studies also indicate that there are, if you compare in the National Health Mobility Survey, the rural areas, the mental health issues, the mental health problem statistics are actually coming up. And at one point of time, it was even higher than the urban. So we are also wondering why.
We don't know the exact
because we do not have any study to actually show what are the exact factors. But possibly we talk about financial constraint and tragic life events. These are the things that can contribute to people having poor mental health issues, poor mental health, and relate to bigger mental health issues. And we have to look at also the other statistics, for example, like crime rates, for example, like what is the rates for child abuse, things, for example, child abuse and neglect and divorce rate, you know, because if you look at the root cause for mental health problems, you only get people coming up with mental disorders or mental health problems. If you get them in health facilities, that would be after they have actually crossed that bridge of having that, between that fine line of having that mental health issues. It started off with it and developed into things like depression or anxiety or even other disorders. And at that point of time, at that brim line, when they actually crossed over, of course, we get the output. The health people, the health facilities will get the product, you know. But beforehand, because mental health problems goes even before preclinical.
Yep.
You know, you have to look at the root cause. What is actually? If you look at the, I would love to use the word of mental well-being rather than just mental health problems, because it is when you want to have a good mental health or mental well-being. Because if you go back to the definition of mental health, it's very, when you say, how do you define a good mental health? But WHO has also given a good mental health would actually, you are mentally healthy when you are comfortable with yourself, when you are comfortable with other people, and when you can accept life challenges. So basically, at any point of time in your life, if there is a crisis, sometimes people face a stress, everybody faces stress, but when you are given some form of a crisis, or you are actually undergoing through life difficulties, that's when your coping skills and your resilience
come through
and teaches you.
Yeah. And we're all different, isn't it?
Yes,
some of us
different.
More resilient than the rest. Uh-uh. And we also know it is biopsychosocial.
And it's also genetic. Sometimes we forget about that, because some people, they don't choose to be depressed.
That's right. I think we mustn't forget that, that mental illness is more than depression and anxiety.
Yeah,
it also extends to conditions that are caused genetically.
The imbalance in
chemical
your chemical imbalance in your
in the brain.
Brain, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
So
we'll come back in just a short while to discuss policies that are in place to ensure access to treatment and care for mental health problems in Malaysia. I think it's a huge problem. We don't even have enough psychiatrists or psychologists. So if that's the case, is there such a thing as access? Or, you know, and where do we go from here? Population standing at 32 million, you said. That's a lot. And one third of us with some sort of not being in equilibrium as far as our mental health is concerned, I'm worried now. If you have a question for any one of our guests, if you've gone through, had a personal experience with the public sector or accessing mental health facilities, or if you want to just share a story with us, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Savisoli. In our Health and Living segment today, Azrul Muhammad Khalid from the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy joining us. It's our public health series on mental health. So in the studio with us, Dr. Noura Shikin Ibrahim, from a public health physician from the Mental Health Unit, Ministry of Health Malaysia, better known as Dr. Anne, and Lim Sulian, who's an analyst at the Penang Institute. Earlier on, we spoke about the prevalence of mental health in Malaysia. One in three of us not in equilibrium. I'm not going to say that one in three of us actually has a mental health problem. One in three of us not in equilibrium as far as our mental health is concerned. We are on that spectrum somewhere. And adolescents who had suicidal ideation thoughts between 2012 and 2017 has gone up from 7.9% to 10%. So 10% of our adolescents have some sort of suicidal ideation, and it's something that we need to look at. That's only suicidal ideation. We're not talking about other issues. Some of the reasons for this increase in one in three of us not being in equilibrium, well, increase in population, perhaps, urbanization and how that's affected us, the change in our social structures, all contribute towards this equilibrium. And WHO's definition of mental health is whether or not you're comfortable with yourself, whether or not you are comfortable with other people, and whether you're able to cope with life challenges is the definition. So, how do we figure out whether we're in equilibrium or not? I would really like to know. When am I crossing that mark that, you know, I might need some help?
I think one of the things that, we have our clinical practice guideline. I'm just focusing on depression for the moment because depression is the most commonest mental disorder, and some people do not like to say that, oh, I'm having mental disorder, that is depression. But the fact that you're having depression, you need to actually identify the symptoms. The early warning signs would be, people can be sad, like Sulin was saying, although the fact that you can be mentally healthy, but at some times when your cat, I wouldn't say die, pass away, you lose your cat, you lose your loved ones, and yes, you are sad, and your sadness probably prolong, and sometimes you do go into that period of grief, you have to grieve. But when it reaches the stage when you have persistent sadness almost every day, at almost every, during that, the whole day, and you have it most frequently almost the day, every day for actually more than 2 weeks, that persistent sadness will give you an indication that probably, yes, you are going into the phase of depression. And the other important symptom that you may need to actually look out is actually when you have lost interest in the things that you used to like to do. For example, like you don't like coming to even host the show, and then it's been you don't get out of bed. Sometimes the other symptoms would be loss. Sometimes, most of the time, it's having sleeping problems. Like you wake
insomnia.
Up very insomnia. Insomnia is a very technical term, people know. You wake up very early in the morning for Muslims. It's not, some people say, yes, I do, doctor, I pergi sembahyang tahajud. I kata, yeah. But, you wake up, you just got up and you can't sleep, and you don't sleep in the middle of the night. You know, people are sleeping, you're still awake for whatsoever reason. But it continues to go on. You have problems in eating. You don't eat. You can't get out of bed. If you've lived with a person who's depressed, then you would probably understand.
I think, you could probably put it in a nutshell to do it. I think it plays a lot into your quality of life and how you would function before and after you develop a mental health condition. I think one of the, as Dr. N has listed out very articulately, the specific conditions, but I think all of us, in some sense, we operate on a day-to-day basis. We carry out or social activities. We can go to work. We can take ourselves places, enjoy things.
But you don't enjoy anymore.
So when does it cross over to a threshold where you are unable to do these
function?
Things?
Yeah,
you are unable to function on a daily basis. Yeah.
I just wanted to go back to an earlier point that Sulian made concerning the movement of people and how, you know, basically we're looking at 40% of the Malaysian population actually moving into the cities by 2020. We're going to be able to see quite a large number of people concentrated in these urban areas.
And that's 70%, am I correct?
I think it's...
Migration. Think a lot of us will be living in cities. Yeah. 70% of the population.
70%?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
More than
yeah.
two-thirds of the developing world.
I mean for Malaysia.
Yeah.
So when you look at it, we are... In a way, we're living in very close and in confined, dense areas. Yet, I get the sense that we're becoming increasingly alone in many respects.
Reduction in nuclear families.
Yes,
probably.
But you know, I've visited some of the lower income areas of Klang Valley, and I've spent time working in PPR flats, for example, and the density of people all packed into a very square footage of space, you know, and living conditions and so forth. And I can't help but when I'm there and to hear the litany of problems which range from, you know, violence to harassment to mental health and so forth, but I get this impression that when it comes to access to services, that you are separated by socioeconomic determinants, whether or not you can afford. Whether you can afford the time, the money for to access these services, and for much more, if you're in the B40, it sounds like, first of all, you don't have the time to go for these services, you can't go to some of these services, and most importantly, you can't afford them. Whereas if you're in the M40 or, you know, the high income level groups, you seem to have the ability to access some of them. You can go to a psychologist or a mental health expert to get treated for those problems. So am I right in saying that even when we're trying to access some of these services for which we have to ask whether there are any really in abundance, it's even then determinant on whether or not we can afford to pay for these services? I mean, these factors are coming to play and determining whether people can get treated.
Okay. First of all, in Malaysia, we have actually what we call, probably many may not know, we have what we call as Dasar Kesihatan Mental Negara,
or National Policy.
Yeah, it has been developed since way back in the year 1998. And one of the things in the policy is actually to ensure comprehensive coverage of mental health care. In terms of now the way forward is to have an integrated mental health care into the primary care service. And in the Ministry of Health, I cannot comment on other facilities, but in the Ministry of Health, we have more than, we have, of course, the four mental institutions that actually cater for the people who are mentally ill. And we have more than about 43 to 45 hospitals who have psychiatric services and mental health services. And
49 at the last count.
49.
It was in the tertiary care hospitals.
We're talking about the big hospitals. Our number is still 45 and between that lah, sometimes. Okay, anyway, we have more than 950 clinics, health clinics, actually providing mental health services that is integrated into the other healthcare system. That means on top of the services that when you see at the OPD, you see people with hypertension, the people with diabetes coming in, heart problems, and even... you have those services coupled with also mental health services ranging from mental health promotion right down to rehabilitation. And I think a lot of people probably, when you talk about access to healthcare, you were saying that, people cannot afford. But then in every facility, for example, if you live in a certain housing area, within 5 kilometres, there's always a clinic kesihatan.
Sure.
Yeah, and you can actually go to the clinic kesihatan because we have placed... there are family medicine specialists there. And
they're trained in mental health?
Family medicine specialists, yes, they are trained.
Are they considered counsellors or what are they?
They are medical doctors, similar to, if you can say, it's in the private, we call them general practitioner, but in the Klinik Kesehatan, we have a specialist called the family medicine specialist, mm-hmm. and they diagnose depression, they diagnose mental disorders, they even start medication there. And of course, the severe ones are being referred to the tertiary care. And it's not, sometimes people say, how do we get treatment? Because probably the stigma of actually going, and the fact that, you know, when you go there, and probably we also need to actually strengthen our skills of the staff,
yes.
our support system staff, in the sense of to actually say the right words and refer appropriately.
If I could add on to that, I think it's true that mental health services are being provided at primary level now. I would say that it's very difficult for a family medicine doctor to be able to diagnose accurately a mental health condition, because most of the time they present as psychosomatic symptoms.
Yes.
What I mean by that, yep. Someone with depression might not come to you and say that, you know.
I disagree with that, because our family medicine specialists are seeing people with mental disorders a lot. Mm. And only that, probably that... in terms of people may have hypertension. So one of the things that we're doing is actually we are screening. We are doing screening at the primary healthcare level. Yep. But when we're doing the screening, we also probably now in the process to actually identify the high-risk groups. Because
What do you mean by high-risk groups?
High-risk groups are people with... because we know that if you have mental... for example, if you have physical illnesses, if you can still remember, physical health is also related to mental health.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes people with probably have diabetes, the NCDs, you know, do have probably depression, but they go undiagnosed. So now these are the time that actually we need to actually educate our healthcare staff and to actually look at this and be more aware, because we are incorporating mental health into the care of chronic disorders.
So I'm very curious, if you're not trained as a mental health practitioner or a mental health specialist, as in you're not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, will you then miss? I mean, you have the DSM-5 and, you know, are they actually following those sort of guidelines when you're diagnosing? You know, it's much more than...
One of the things that, of course, when you say about you might miss, or you say that you need people with train to actually diagnose. But I think the most important thing, when you talk about, we are always focusing on treatment and care. We are not focusing so much on putting preventive. The efforts on preventive efforts and way beyond actually addressing the root causes of what is actually causing the mental health problems and mental health issues. So I think we have to go one more step beyond.
I mean,
that.
I think it works both ways.
But of course, we need the counselors. We need the. But these are the things that we also need to educate among the people in the mental health care, because for people to seek help, the stigma is very strong. So we need to break that stigma. And there was personally sometimes when I try to convince the patients, sometimes people tweet to you. And people PM messages you saying that, where can I get help? Mm-hmm. Say, you go to the nearest clinic. The nearest clinic is not necessarily a health, government health clinic. It can be a private clinic, you know. But of course, private clinic, it is costly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people can't afford it. So for those who can't afford, of course, we push them to the health clinic. And hopefully we can get a referral. It's just a simple referral to the hospital.
I have it in the 2014 MOH report that 28,720 cases of mental health cases were actually treated at primary care clinics. Mm-hmm. 28,000 cases sounds like a big number on paper, but when you compare that to the NHMS statistics that we've just been reading to, the 1 in 3.
It's only less than how many percent? Probably.
It's a fraction.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
We are only detecting about less than 5% at the primary healthcare that's coming forward to
Correct.
Get help.
Yep. So that feeds into the point that I was trying to make, that you know, when it comes to actually having proper detection mechanisms in place, there has to be someone who is trained to diagnose and is familiar with the symptoms to be able to pick up these people.
Okay. We'll come back and find out the mental, the financial challenges facing those seeking with mental health treatment for mental health treatment, as well as this financial burden, the consequences of stigmatizing the whole people suffering from mental illnesses. You know, we talk about eliminating the stigma, but it's not as easy as it sounds. As you said earlier, Sulin, there's so many factors. Our cultural beliefs, our values and belief system, really. It all differs as to how we perceive what mental health problems is. I mean, I think in the office when I talk about it, I see so many different reactions, and it's really not funny.
Yeah, because, it's not funny.
Yes, and it stems from how your parents, you know, spoke about people with mental health issues, how your grandparents spoke about it, and it just creeps on, you know. So we're having this conversation. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon. If you have just joined us, I am Meera Sivasuthi. In our seventh series, a public health series, today's topic is on mental health. Azrul Ahmad Khalid from the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy joining me as co-host, and Dr. Noor Ashikin Ibrahim, a public health physician from the Mental Health Unit, Ministry of Health, in the studio together with analysts from the Penang Institute, Lim Soo Lin. And we are having a lengthy discussion about what mental health is, our access to mental health. But Azrul, you have a question for them.
No, I think one of the things you mentioned earlier is who is at the front line. And you mentioned just now people at the PHC, the primary healthcare level, are going to be the people who are spotting those people who are having mental health issues. And it seems to me that there's a lot that's riding on these doctors, these medical professionals, to be able to do that job. It seems that on top of everything else, they're also needing to do this. And I'm just wondering at this point, you know, I mean, with on top of all the things that they're looking at, will they honestly have the time to properly diagnose a person with a mental health issue when there's a backlog of 30 or 40 patients outside there waiting, and they're expected to go through a factory line of, what, 5 minutes, 10 minutes per patient? I mean, is this something that is a real concern?
Okay, it is, yes. Thank you for bringing that up, Azrul. Apparently, I think the movement now, our way forward is probably to also strengthen our primary healthcare, because primary healthcare in terms of the training, in terms of training of our frontliners, primary healthcare staff, because one is actually on how to deal with, let's say, for example, a person comes to you, you're a nurse or you're a medical assistant, and a patient comes to you and then suddenly blurted out saying that, I think I don't want to live. I think I want to commit suicide. So how do you respond to that, you know? And you have to go to that extent to make sure that these staff are prepared, because Ministry of Health previously actually, we actually did, I think there was a study also done, there was a survey, and to say that actually the way forward is actually to strengthen the skills of the primary healthcare staff. Okay, but on the other hand also, on another note, we probably need to also look into the placements of counsellors at the primary health care, because at this point of time, our Ministry of Health counsellors, we do not have many. We have about 176. Of that figure, if I'm not
for the whole country,
no, for only Ministry of Health.
The Ministry of Health,
Because Ministry of Health, because we have many clinical psychologists, but clinical psychologists, most of them are in the private sector.
I would qualify that and say we don't have many clinical psychologists. We have a lot of psychologists. Clinical psychologists.
No, clinical psychologists. We have about more than 200. I think that's more than 200 all over the country. Elvin gave me that figure
in the public and private sector.
Yes,
in the public.
Public sector,
in the MOH,
there's only 24.
Very, very few.
24?
Yes, in the public sector. That means in the Ministry of Health. I can only give you that figure. 24? And 24
15
is
in 2017.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So 24, we've done well. What about psychiatrists?
Psychiatrists, we have about, throughout the whole Malaysia, I think the figure is about 322. But we only have about 200 plus in the. Of course, we have the psychiatrists who are still doing
training
and things like that.
But serving one in three of us who could possibly have a mental health problem.
Yeah. But then Mira, I think I would actually, because a lot of focus are being given. People always ask us, how many psychiatrists do you have? How many clinical psychologists do you have? How many counselors do you have? But then I think we have to look at not just counselors within the Ministry of Health and in other organizations, because if we were to look at the root cause of our mental health problems, it lies beyond probably family issues, you know, even self-perception, their own self, inner self, their expectations and things like that. So we also need to convince other agencies and other ministries. For example, how do you actually detect people with mental issues early at their workplace? And probably at that point of time, if you can actually do some intervention there at that, for example, in your workplace, BHM, you don't even have a peer support group. Example, do we have it? Do we have our peer support group in any organization?
Well, actually, I have to say we're very progressive. We just started to give an allocation of money for people for mental health.
Good.
So, yes.
I'm so happy.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. For
treatment.
Thank you.
For treatment, yes.
Oh,
there's a cap for it because mental health treatment can go on and on. Yeah. But there is a cap for it. But at least we get you to get some help, which we think is important.
So, Dr. Anne, if I'm reading if I'm hearing you right, you're talking more of a shifting of the responsibility purely from the healthcare delivery side, from the MH side, to more community shouldering responsibilities,
because mental health issues is everyone's business.
Yes, I think health in general is everyone's business, not just mental health.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
And really, government cannot cope with everything.
But the prevalence is very high, Mira. So I think we need to actually also work together, because one of the things that we are working on is actually to collaborate with. We have collaborated with many agencies. Among them is Ministry of Education, whereby we actually initiated and mooted the idea of implementing the Healthy Mind program in school. Mm-hmm. If you've heard, so now we have about 2,343 schools, secondary schools, implementing the Healthy Mind program.
Okay, we have Jade who has a question. Jade, go ahead.
Hey, my question is in regards to mental health training outside of the clinical setting.
Okay.
Where enforcement officers, like enforcement, like such as the police and court, there's been some involvement in some cases of mental health problems. And it has been observed that there has been a lack of compassion demonstrated by these enforcement officers. So my question is, how well-versed are our authorities or our enforcement officers, such as our police and our courts, in the subject of mental health?
Okay. Thank you very much, Jade. That's a very quick, good question, because it brings me to the question of that suicide is punishable in this country.
It's criminalized.
It is.
Yes, it is. Suicidal behavior, suicide attempt is punishable.
Carries a fine
jail. Of the Penal Code, Section 309.
It's a Penal Code offense.
we have...
do we do this? You know, really?
You've got to look back to history.
Okay.
And we've had a very long... I think we've got to call the police into and the law, not just myself.
Yeah.
And I think the Penal Code was actually... It was many, many years ago for the fact that also... To the in the law side, I think it is they have some reasons why they created that particular. We are actually, to tell you, we have had a very, very in-depth discussion with. We even had a seminar last year to debate about decriminalizing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, it is still ongoing. That is as much I can say, that we are pushing towards decriminalizing suicide, but it will take a long time.
But you know, Dr. Anne, you should just go ahead and say it. This is an obsolete, unuseful law that really should be repealed.
I think we have to look into the spirit of the Penal Code,
Code,
which is essentially to prevent and reduce crime, criminal activities.
Yep. And, on
and then we need to think about, is suicide something that ought to be criminalized? I mean, different countries, different administrations who have different approaches. But
Does it have a deterrent value?
Does it have a deterrent value? Yeah. Exactly, is the question that we need to be asking. Now, if you were to put yourself in the shoes of someone who is going through extreme emotional distress and has just tried to throw him or herself off a building.
Off a building.
And then drag him to court and tell him that, you know, he has to serve a jail term or to have a fine.
Because further distress.
Yes. And this person will eventually have to return to his or her community, to his or her families. And with having this criminal dagger, this brand of stigma over his head. Personally, I do not think at all that it is helpful in addressing the issue or helping the person to get to a better place. In fact, if anything, it will cause the opposite effect because he will not be wanting to go and seek the help that he needs.
I think in certain countries, they have decriminalized. So we are looking, Ministry of Health has actually taken efforts and we are looking into it. In fact, to actually work towards decriminalising suicide. But of course, it's a policy that we need to work together with the police.
But that's on one level.
Yes.
But as you also said earlier, the hospital staff,
studies have actually shown, this is from the studies from the countries that actually has decriminalised suicide, that the effects of decriminalising is it leads to a better mental health, actually.
Okay, but I think education is important
on all levels. Yes,
whether it's the police force, whether it's the legal people in the legal system, it's people working in hospitals.
The other thing I think I suppose that we are also working on is actually when you talk about somebody was asking how do you train the police? Even within the police sector, they have counselors. I know of that actually to deal with this issue also, but even then, of course, we also need to train a lot of the frontliners, not just the police, but the people in their prison, the staff in the prison of actually how to deal with mental health issues because. This is very important, especially in the concept of mental health first aid or also psychological first aid.
Okay, fantastic. We're running out of time. Yeah. It's a new Malaysia. If you're talking about reform agenda, what would you like to say to us? What would you like to leave us with, Sulin?
Yeah. Especially the Minister of Health. What would you like for him to hear?
Well, I'm very encouraged that in Promise 9 of the manifesto, which concerns improving access to quality of health services, there is a provision which states that more government resources will be channeled to mental health care. Mm-hmm. I think this idea of providing prompt diagnostic assessment and appropriate care, that should be made available for people who need it and who actually actively seek it, is a really forward motion.
Yeah.
But looking forward into the future as well, I think it would be foolhardy to think of mental health care in terms of an isolated healthcare policy. I think we need to think about how to mainstream conversations about mental health into a broad spectrum of policies. In other words, what I'm saying is that we need to really focus on people-centered development policies. And that will lead into the government needing to look into a lot of things, ensuring that there are sufficient job opportunities, building more affordable housing, more comfortable homes, reducing the burden of cost of living, empowering people to have more educational opportunities, because all of these factors interconnect and have a great impact on our physical and mental health. And I think if there's anything that I would like to leave with to the health minister and the current government, it would be that.
Dr. Anne.
Okay. I think when you talk about mental health, I'm on my capacity as a person who's done mental health for the past 15 years. I would like to actually, hopefully that we can, Ministry of Health can actually get other ministries or even other agencies to be involved in also not just mental health efforts, that means mental health promotion efforts, and also putting mental health in the agenda of their own policy for example, because mental health is, we are also looking at target groups, for example, when you talk about adolescent children, you know, and I quote that this morning when we had a briefing with our deputy minister, in fact, we were saying that, he was saying that disaster can happen in many forms of life. Disaster can happen, for example, like you have a bad marriage, you are divorced, and you go into financial crisis. So things like that affects mental health, and we have to address the roots of the things that are causing the mental health problems. And those are the way forward. And also looking at settings, for example, because we know that people go to school and you have dropouts, you know, from schools, you have problems at workplace, you know, and in fact at the community level, I think people centered.
Yes. I agree. And when we're talking about, just one more thing to add about the target groups as well, we need to also consider marginalized groups,
yes,
people who may not necessarily fall into public policies but who deserve the treatment and healthcare attention, okay, for like refugees, LGBT communities.
Azrul?
Well, I'm just looking at some of the points that we were mentioning just now, especially in decentralizing all of those services. Don't expect people to go to you. We need to go and reach out to these communities that need help.
Okay, thank you all very much
for sharing your thoughts, Mira,
with us.
Thank you so much.
Azrul Mahmud Khalib from the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, Dr. Nurashikin Ibrahim from Ministry of Health, and Lim Sulin, an analyst from the Penang Institute, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.